Call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. A quorum is present. Today, members, we have four bills. Representative Claflin, Representative Carlson, Chair Mariani, and then mine that I hope will pass. But we have the minutes first that have been reviewed by Chair Johnson. Moves the minutes from March 10th, 2020. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the minutes that they be approved for March 10th, 2020? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of March 10th are approved. First bill up today is Representative Claflin, who's ready in the front row. There's no fiscal note on this bill, so it's referred to us under subdivision 4, the penalties provision. So that's what we're going to be limiting our discussion to. I move that House File 3181 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Claflin, please tell us about your bill. Oh, did you, is this your first time in judiciary?
Ooh.
Ooh. Yeah.
It is my first time in judiciary, and I'm afraid all I have are some leftover hamantaschen from Frank Hornstein in my bag. So if you want a hamantaschen.
So we have some students here today. From Burnsville, right? You're all from Burnsville? Okay. What year are you?
Seniors.
Okay. Do you haze freshmen?
No, that's illegal.
Do?
Yeah, be careful with that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we routinely haze our freshmen around here as well. And when they come to committee for the first time with a bill, they have to bring treats to get it through. So that's what we're doing to Representative Claflin here today. And I can tell you the standards have really just kind of gone out the window. But we're going to let you go ahead, with the bill anyway. Go ahead, Representative Claflin, to your bill. And welcome to the students from Burnsville.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Instead of the treat, you can take a little bit of solace in the fact that I'm not bringing you the pictures of the problems that these non-flushable wipes can cause. They were very colorful, and in commerce, the words icky and ooky were used, I think, for the first time. So you're not getting the photos.
Thank you.
These disposable wipes cause a lot of clogs in our sewer pipes and in the pumps, and the result is maintenance and repair costs for our communities. And we heard testimony from cities all over the state about the high costs that they have to deal with these problems. And what my bill does is, if a product is going to be labeled as flushable, it has to meet these flushable standards. And right now there are industry standards for what flushable means. This bill does not require labeling of any other products. If it's not flushable, it doesn't require that it be labeled not flushable. It doesn't ban any products, and we can still use these products. What we really want out of this is a solid education campaign, but we can't educate people about what is flushable and what is not flushable and causing these enormous problems if we don't have the accurate labeling in the first place. So if we want to tell people don't flush anything unless it's labeled flushable, we have to have the right label that it's flushable. We really just need to keep them out of our sewers. So the penalties part of this bill would set a maximum penalty at $5,000 and a penalty of $100 for each package that violates that standard. That if it was labeled as flushable and it did not meet that standard, it would be subject to those penalties.
You have testifiers, is that right, Representative Claflin?
No, I did not bring any testifiers for this bill. They would have brought pictures.
Oh, yes,
but I believe the League of Minnesota Cities is here to answer any questions about that side of the issue.
Okay. And is there anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3181? I don't see any hands. We'll move to committee discussion. Questions, comments? Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. And I actually did see a thing on the one of the news magazines. And I believe it was New York, where they had a ball of these things in their sewer that was about 10 feet by 10 feet. And I want to say it was like $1 million to get it through on taxpayers' backs to clean out their sewer system. So thank you for bringing this forward. I think maybe we might want to be a little more punitive even, given the amount of money it's costing taxpayers in some of the bigger locales. They mentioned two or three different places where they had huge costs to try to clean through their sewer system. So.
Well, and I think anyone who's done any international travel knows that most of the places you go to, if they have the plumbing, well, depending on where you go to, you can't ever flush anything. I mean, like even toilet paper, because of the impacts it has on the pipes. But you know, in the United States, we're pretty used to flushing a lot. And I also hear from public works people when I used to work for the city of some of the problems and costs associated with these. Cyril. Do we have costs related to local units of government, what they've borne in relation to, and I know it's hard to separate these out, okay, because it could be anything. The roots grow through the pipes, and then there it's augmented or made worse by non-flushable wipes. But do we have costs associated with that are specific to the non-flushable wipes?
I do have some costs. It is related to the clogs, and the clogs are usually caused by non-flushable objects. It's mostly made up of those flushable wipes, but then there's other non-flushable things like sanitary products, even diapers somehow get flushed, matchbox cars occasionally.
Yeah.
But these fiber balls are what are causing the clogs, and that's what the costs are really addressing. And in Minnetonka, the city is spending $1,000 to $1,500 for each clog, and they've got about 8 to 10 every year. Sometimes that sewage even backs up into people's homes. In Avon, further up north, they have spent about $73,000 to upgrade the pumps so they can have more of these products passing through, and because of damage to the pumps. Other cities have had to buy equipment to shred the material, and that can range from $15,000 to $70,000, sometimes even in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for the equipment to shred all the material that's coming in.
Can I have one question, Representative Claflin. Can they shred an Elsa finger puppet? Because that's what I found in my sink drain last week. I have a three-year-old. That's a rhetorical question. Representative Mueller. No. Representative Herr. Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question to the bill author. But I would say, first of all, I agree with the concern of this. I've had the public works staff in my own city has had a conversation with me on this. This was maybe four years ago, where the lift station in our own neighborhood burnt out as a result of this. It burnt out, and the city had to replace it because of these, and they had photographs of these in the lift station. But the question I have for you is, when I'm looking at subdivision 2, the prohibition, they can't be advertised unless it meets the criteria set in subdivision 1, clause 3. So I look to that, and I see that it's the commissioner of the pollution control agency that is responsible for approving package labeling. My question is, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author, is there precedence for this? Is the pollution control agency in? Do they have the knowledge to be able to approve packaging, or would this be the first time that they have to approve the marketing on packaging?
Can you answer that, Representative Claflin? You got to call phone a friend or let us know.
Chair and Representative Lucero, the Pollution Control Agency has testified in support of this bill. I'm not sure if they are in the audience.
Any PCA people here?
Nope. Well, and I can amend my question, Mr. Chair.
In the Environmental Committee at the moment. But they have testified in support of this bill and supported it in the past. So they must feel that they are capable of doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then my comment to the bill author would be, if somebody needs to approve packaging, I'm not persuaded, while they may be in support of the bill, I'm not persuaded that they are the most appropriate agency to approve that. So I would just throw it out to you, as this advances, consider potentially somebody else if this is not the best use of their time. So thank you.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Claflin. It's interesting reading some of the material in our packets, and what's interesting is you said you had mentioned that most of these clogs are from the flushable wipes. According to INDA, with their information that they provided us, the municipal studies on the clogs were non-flushable wipes being flushed down the toilet. So it's not an issue of the flushable wipes, it's the non-flushables being pushed down there.
Representative Claflin.
This is going after the flushable issue. Are you trying to make the packaging, the label, non-flushable larger so people don't put them down the toilet?
Representative Claflin.
I believe you may have misheard me speak that the clogs are caused by the non-flushable wipes. Those that really are flushable break down in the process and don't cause these clogs. It's the non-flushable wipes that are mistakenly being flushed that are causing the problems. And I believe you have a handout that looks something like this, a different one. But this bill does not go after labeling of the non-flushable products. On most of the non-flushable products, there are already labels that show a little toilet inside a do not do sign saying do not flush this. There have been products that are labeled as flushable that do not meet these flushable standards. And what this bill is doing is making sure that if there are products labeled as flushable, they must meet these standards. There are still going to be the non-flushable wipes. They're still going to be labeled as non-flushable, and they still should not be flushed. But this bill is just trying to make sure that if it's going to be labeled as flushable, and our education campaign says don't flush anything unless it says flushable, that we're accurate in what we're telling people to do.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, going back to from the INDA letter. I'm going to read exactly their wording. Municipal studies of clogs / accumulations indicate flushing of wipes not labeled flushable as up to 99% of the problem. So it's not the problem, it's not the flushable wipe, it's people flushing the stuff that's labeled not flushable or labeled or not labeled flushable. It's not the flushable wipe issue. It's the people flushing the stuff that's labeled not flushable down the toilet. So I think it's more of an educational thing because the industry's already at the federal level has standards put in place and dealing with the labeling. So they're getting the labeling on the flushable wipes, and the flushable wipes do break down, don't cause an issue. I understand it is a problem. The problem is the fact that the people flushing the wrong stuff down the toilet.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Claflin, I'm looking at subdivision 3 of your bill starting on line 1.16. And I appreciate the term flushability, septic or sewer safe. But I'm also wondering if there is a definition that is missing or is already in statute that would pertain to degradable, whether or not degradable should be included. Because, Mr. Chair, it's not only about, in my opinion, as the bill would pertain to the act of flushing, but I think that it also might pertain to what we put in our dishwashers and in our laundry products with the pods and whatnot that are contained within plastic that sometimes does not degrade as well. So I'm wondering if that circumstance is not covered by this, or are we just narrowly defining flushability of flushable WAPs and whether or not they are degradable or not. And maybe this FTC docket number pertains to that, mm-hmm. but I haven't had a chance to look at that. But I'm just wondering if Representative Claflin would have any remarks regard to that.
Well, Representative Claflin, go ahead and answer mm-hmm. that if you can. I would remind members that the reason this bill is here is for Subdivision 4, the penalties provisions. This has already gone through Environment and Commerce to discuss a lot of this other stuff. But go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Chair Lesh and Representative Albright. There are standards in the non-woven disposable fabrics industry code that do describe what the word you said was dispersible or
degradable.
Degradable. What those standards look like, how much of the product must be degraded in a certain period of time. And Mr. Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities is also here to help answer that question.
Do you have an answer to that, Mr. Johnson, briefly?
Mr. Chair and members, to both of the last two questions. So this bill.
You need to introduce yourself.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. To the last two questions, Mr. Chair and members. The labeling requirement in this is for non-woven disposable products that are not flushable. The concern is that right now, for us to educate people in our cities of what they should and should not be flushing, the industry has a voluntary standard and a voluntary label that they encourage members of their industry to use, but it is voluntary. This bill says it can't be voluntary. If you have a non-flushable item, it needs to be labeled non-flushable. We are using the same standard the industry recommends and the same label the industry recommends. But we want to make sure if it shouldn't be flushed, they all have that label. As to the degradable, there are a number of factors taken in that are used in determining what should be labeled. It is referenced in this bill with a reference to an FCC docket number in Subdivision 1.3. There is another thing. It's referred to as, I believe, GD4, if I remember correctly. There's another document that is being now implemented in the European Union that would be what that represents. And it discusses how long it takes for something that is flushed to break up into something that won't contribute to a clog. That's what it defines. But it only applies to these types of wipes. It does not apply to other types of products. This bill only looks at disposable fabric wipes.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To your point then, Mr. Chair, with regard to Subdivision 4 starting at line 2.21, it seems to me that for decades we have had penalties on the books and enforcement actions relevant to false advertising. Why would we need a new subdivision or a statute pertaining just to flushables when false advertising also already has the parameters that would pertain to this product?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what this is really going after is not people who are putting a big label on that says flushable, although there is a case where that happened. What this is going after is ones that just don't say anything, but they're not supposed to be flushed. And we want to make sure that those are labeled as do not flush. That's what this is about. There was a recent case where someone said something was flushable that wasn't, but existing enforcement mechanisms were used to end that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. The last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, my question is to you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you can help enlighten, after you narrowed it down to Subdivision 4. So paragraph B under Subdivision 4, I don't have the longevity that you do. I'm just wondering if you can help explain the Attorney General portion of this. Is this language that's been more recent in the last several years of adding Attorney General language to provisions, or is this something that's been a common practice for a while?
Well, Representative Lucero, I know I've brought this in before, this type of language. So in reality, there is the, I forget the which section of his statute that explicitly authorizes the list of actions that the Attorney General may bring. And then there's a catch-all that this would fall under, in my opinion, that this type of action would fall under. However, in my experience in the past, courts have been skittish or reluctant to do things unless it's explicitly spelled out for them. And so I think that's what the author is intending to do with this language. Maybe I'm putting words in your mouth about this, but, you know, yeah, it adds it to the statute that explicitly allows Attorney General action for enforcement. Otherwise, it's going to be up to county attorneys, or I guess the Attorney General himself at this point, to pick which catch-all statute he's going to try to enforce this under. So, okay, is there anyone else? I see no other discussion from the committee. The motion on the motion before us is that House File 3181 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The House File 3181 is placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Claflin. And I know you'll bring treats back at some point.
You want to have them, Tashin?
Do you have them with you here? How many you got? You got enough for everybody?
No, I got five.
You got five. You need to come back. Can you do the Jesus thing with the loaves and fishes, you know, make
not
more? Okay, well, that's fine. We'll let you slide. Come back next one. You know, are we, okay. We're doing Carlson next year?
Oh, come on, I'm here.
I know. That's why we do, the people who are here, we typically do them last, but that's fine. Okay. They're all our people. Okay. Okay, Representative Carlson moves that House File 3878 be recommended to be referred to the Property and Local Tax Division. Going back to your committee, Representative Carlson, and you have no amendments, so go ahead with your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 3878. The goal of this bill is to allow the Department of Revenue to implement a system to let renters file their property tax refund electronically. So for all the landlords in the room, currently there's a form that needs to be filled out. This is going to allow that to happen online, finally. Currently, homeowners are able to file electronically, and the department would like to provide the same service to renters who are claiming a property tax refund. In order to create an electronic system for renters, we need to have landlords provide us, the state, with an electronic certificate of rent paid, which is the document we use to verify that renters claim their refund with. Many landlords and managing agents already have an account with the Department of Revenue for their own tax purposes and have already provided the Social Security number or tax identification number, and thus are able to use the current pilot project that's in place. For landlords or property owners who do not have the account, they would need to gather that Social Security number or individual tax ID number. So that can be used in the system to submit electronic certificates of rent paid, which is, of course, then used to claim the property tax refund. So that essentially is the bill. I do have representatives from the Department of Revenue to speak in favor of the bill if necessary, but happy to entertain any questions.
Okay, well, we'll stand for questions. Is there anyone from the audience, the public here, who wants to be heard, as opposed to just being a resource for Representative Carlson, who wants to be heard on House File 3878? And I see no raised hands. So we'll move to committee discussion, and if you got to call up your folks for questions, that's okay, Chair Carlson. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wondered if I might hear from the folks from the Department of Revenue, because I'm a landlord and I just have some questions about
Revenue, come on,
how this is going to work. Yeah.
Go ahead and ask your question, Chair Scott.
So my question, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still not clear why the Department of Revenue needs, let me rephrase that. Would this information be on the certificate of rent form? Would there be a spot to include that information? Is that what you're looking at doing?
you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it would not be included on the form. The reason we're asking for this Social Security number, there's individual taxpayer identification number, is in order to log into our services. So if you're a business, you use our e-service system to log in and do your sales tax return or your withholding. This would be the same setup. Currently, we don't have that system available for individuals, and so this is why we need to register the individuals that would be issuing that certificate of rent paid.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not, can you just walk through how this would practically work out? So a renter wants to file electronically. Are you saying they need this information to log in? Because I'm not going to hand over my Social Security number to my tenant.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so currently the Social Security number or the landlord's ID number is not placed on the form. So what would happen is every year when you get your property tax refund, the landlord would fill out the CRP. Currently, right now, what they do is they give it to the renter. The renter then turns around and fills out the property tax refund form, and they submit to the department. What we're trying to do in this kind of phase is to have the CRP submitted electronically to the department. The landlord still submits it to the renter as normal, and nothing on the form changes. It's just eventually, in the long run, we want the landlord to submit the CRP to the department electronically, and then the renter could go online and create that property tax refund. So nothing else would change. As for instance, for you being a landlord, you're still submitting the CRP to us and to the renter at this point in the process.
Oh, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the language in this area of statute is all permissive. I don't know if I speak for every landlord, but I was never under the impression that I had to give my CRPs, copies of my CRPs, to the Department of Revenue. And the language up here says we just have to save a copy in case you want it. And I've never been asked for it. So I'm still not clear, even with your explanation, how this process is going to work. So are you saying then that it's now going to be mandatory that I submit a copy of the CRP that I gave the tenant so that you can match those up? I still am not understanding how this is going to work.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now it's we're doing a pilot project, so we're asking landlords to submit or set a program up so that we can get these CRPs submitted. In 2017, the law was changed to require landlords to submit a CRP to the department, and that way we have that information to verify the source of information from the landlord and the taxpayer filing their taxpayer refund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had the exact same question as a landlord myself. So we just heard pilot project. I'm not seeing anywhere in here that this is a pilot project, temporary. Could you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently we're doing a pilot project. This is not for the pilot project. We're asking landlords now during the pilot project to start using our e-services to submit the CRPs, but this is not for the project. So right now it's voluntary, but we are asking that we can start this project for everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so let me ask it this way. I've heard something that started in 2017 in regard. So there's two halves of this equation. We have the tenants and we have the landlords. Mm-hmm. I just heard something that started in 2017 that was a new mandate on landlords. Could you please start with what the process is now from the beginning? So the calendar year comes to an end. The landlord fills out the paperwork, gives that to the tenant. Could you walk through that entire process of what it's supposed to be under the 2017 change you referenced? Then could you please walk through the entire process under what the proposed language is? Because what I'm understanding you to say now is that the landlord fills out the paperwork, not only gives it to the tenant, but now has to give it to the department. So if I'm understanding this correctly, the workload has just doubled from the landlord side of the equation. So again, I'm looking for a walkthrough step by step on both of these processes, current law and what this seeks to do.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask one of our attorneys from the division to come up and help answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and answer the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Hala El-Rashidi. I'm an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be walking you through how the property tax refund then works under current law. So right now, as you said, under statute, landlords are required to give their renter a copy of the Certificate of Rent Paid, the CRP. The law that Ms. Bears referenced that changed in 2017 is to allow the commissioner to require landlords also send a copy of the CRP that was given to the renter to the department. So right now, this pilot program that Ms. Bears referenced is allowing landlords that are currently registered in our e-services program, so current business owners that have already registered with the department would then, under the pilot program, be able to log into their system, into their account, their e-services, provide the information for the CRP, and that would generate CRPs that the landlord would be able to give to their renter. So it's working simultaneously to generate a CRP and provide the commissioner a copy of that certificate of rent paid. What we're asking in this proposal is for the landlords that are not currently registered in e-services to provide the department with their taxpayer identification number in order for them to log into our system and provide that information to the department, generate the CRP, give that to the renter, and at no time would the taxpayer identification number appear on the certificate of rent paid. It is only provided to the department to give the department the information to know the source of the information of that CRP.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, and then two follow-up questions, and that is, under the 2017 explanation, I heard the language, the commissioner could require the landlord to submit. So if I'm understanding correctly, if you could clarify this, right now it's not mandatory. It's only if the commissioner requires a landlord to upload under current law. And then under part two of the question would be, under this program, it sounds like is this mandatory or is it voluntary under this language? So as a landlord who's not presently registered with the Department of Revenue, is this now going to make it mandatory that they register? Or is this, and if it's voluntary now, is this just one step away from making it mandatory next year?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct. Right now, the language is permissive. The commissioner may require, so landlords that are providing, that are using e-services to provide the CRP information, it is voluntary, it's not mandatory. Under the proposed language, it is one step to get closer to the commissioner eventually requiring that CRPs all be submitted to her or to the department. But it's when the CRP is required to be submitted, which it is currently not, then in order to register with the department or to submit that to the department, then the taxpayer identification number would also be required.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That does clarify it for me, and it causes me concern because clearly this is an incremental step to getting it where all landlords, whether or not they have a tax ID, so it might be the Social Security number, to no longer be voluntary but to make it mandatory, and I have concerns with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. I would note that having filled out many of these over the years, the biggest pain in the part of it is getting the property ID number, the correct dates of when you rented to them, how much money they gave you, add that up, you get all that on the sheet. Seems like making another copy of that would be maybe like 3% of the total workload of doing it on the front end. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the way that we do it, and we probably don't do it the most efficiently, but we actually do the hard copy. So by the way, well, one beef that I have is this year it changed significantly from past years. And so it took about twice as much time. I don't know if you've done this year yet. You should have, hopefully.
I sold on my property, thank God.
But it changed significantly, and it was about twice as long to fill out. But my just thinking the way we do it, we print it out, so we have a hard copy, and we're filling out the hard copy, crunching the numbers, the dates, and married couple is counted as one rather than two, and if they have adult children, then it's more than one, and you get questions from your tenants, and they're all frustrated because now they have to split it up and blah, blah, blah. So if I have a hard copy now, in order to upload it, now I need to scan it in to make a digital copy, right? So that's where I'm thinking in my head where my workload is now doubling because I can't just have the hard copy, give it to them. I now have to do more, so thank you.
Sure. Chair Scott. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the testifier at the table is probably maybe wanting to comment on that. But my understanding from what you just said is this is laying the groundwork to have this all done electronically. So it's going to spit out. It's going to take care of it basically for us. We're going to go online and do the CRP, and it's going to be filed. Therefore, it's going to be filed for the tenant and for us. Am I capturing that right? Because it says here in line 1.17, through a simple process, and evidently it's not that simple for what this language is showing us. It's not really clear on what that simple process is going to be. But, Mr. Chair, that would be my question.
Ms. Oshidi.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that would be the goal, that you, as the landlord, would go online, fill out the CRP information. It would generate the CRP that you would then give to the renter, and automatically it would be submitted and provided to the commissioner as well.
Representative Doerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My quick question is, if the landlord uploads this information, does that change the timeline for the refund for the property tax?
Ms. Al-Rashidi.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it should not change the timeline for the property tax refund to go out to the renter.
Mr. Chair, so what is the current timeline for property tax refund to be available to residents?
Mr. Chair, Representative, property tax refunds are due by August 15th of every year, and from then they are processed and issued a few months later.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, I do have a little concern of this going a little too far, too quick. We had confusion already on this bill about what was required in 2017, that these forms had to be already turned into the commissioner as mandated. Then we found out it was a part of a project. But what concerns me, dealing with, especially when you're dealing with tax stuff, is it's getting so complicated we actually had to have a lawyer come up to explain it. When it's getting that far, I think we need to step back and take a good look at what we're doing.
Chair
Scott. Yeah, final question. Have you spoken with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, and what do they have a take on this language and bill?
Sure. Well, who wants to answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we have. We've been working with them in partnership throughout this whole process when we started it back in 2017.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3878. I don't see anyone. And Chair Carlson, your motion is that House File 3878 be recommended be referred to you at the Property and Local Tax Division. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. The bill is referred to the Property and Local Tax Division. Thank you, Chair Carlson. Next bill we have up is Chair Mariani. House File 3975. Members, this bill received a lengthy informational hearing in public safety on March 4th, and so today we'll be hearing the bill in judiciary and voting to send it to the general register. Chairs have discussed this between each other. That's going to be the motion. And Representative Mariani, do you want to move House File 3975 to general register?
Mr. Chair, that is my motion today.
Thank you. Please begin.
Mr. Chair, members, as the chair shared, we had an extensive information hearing on this in public safety. This bill is properly, housed here or placed here within the jurisdiction of this committee. This has to do with judiciary procedures, so it's proper for us to be moving from this point. House File 3975 expands access to existing law, permitting a petition for post-conviction relief to include when a petitioner is facing immigration removal as a result of a conviction that came about by either relying on incorrect advice or having gotten no advice from counsel about immigration consequences. Post-conviction relief is a way to challenge the legality of a constitution or constitutionality of criminal convictions after the period for direct appellate relief has expired, or once all appellate remedies have been exhausted. It's a remedy that's available for all people who have been convicted of a crime in Minnesota. Members, it's been a longstanding principle in Minnesota that when people are wronged by our criminal justice system, and it does occasionally happen, that people have an opportunity to seek justice. PCR, post-conviction relief, is not an automatic relief. It simply provides an opportunity to make a case for relief by having a court review the context of a conviction. It gives a person essentially a day in court for a high-stakes outcome. This bill provides a sixth exception to the two-year time window from conviction within which to petition the court. This bill does not prevent a federal decision on removal or deportation. It simply allows a Minnesota conviction to be reconsidered and to make that reconsidered outcome available for deliberations in federal court. So members, here to quickly share why it's important to expand on this Minnesota principle today. In other words, how it can positively impact the lives of Minnesotans. And to answer questions are Ms. Kai-Ying Yang and Professor Linus Chan.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Lesh and members of the committee. My name is Kai-Ying Yang, and I am the Director of Programs and Partnerships at the Coalition of Asian American Leaders, also known as CAL. I'm also here on behalf of a coalition of organizations working on expanding access to justice through post-conviction relief. We are working together to stop the detention and deportation of former refugees from Southeast Asian and African countries. The PCR coalition has mobilized more than 26 organizations to endorse this bill. In addition to the community organizations, we have also we have the support of three unions and seven government entities, including three county attorney offices. And if you look in the handout that was in your folder, I think, you'll see who those organizations are. Recently, there has been a confirmation that there will be a significant increase of deportation of Hmong, Lao, and other ethnic people with removal orders to Laos. This will have a devastating impact on hundreds of families and perhaps thousands of individuals related to those families in our state. This includes spouses, siblings, parents, and children of those deportation orders, those with deportation orders. In the state of Minnesota, we are home to over 160,000 Southeast Asians, and more than half of them are Hmong, who came to the U.S. as refugees fleeing political persecution from their country of birth and or their parents' country of birth. We cannot ignore this crisis, and neither can you. Most of the Southeast Asians with deportation order came to the U.S. as young children. Growing up in Minnesota, they can barely speak the language of their parents' home country and have no familial relations in the country, in those countries. All have already served their sentences and are being persecuted for crimes from decades ago. One case was 30 years old. Most were in their teens, poor, unable to afford private attorneys, and took plea deals, not knowing that they had agreed to a life sentence of deportation. Immigrants in Minnesota, such as other refugees, Somalis and Liberians, face similar consequences. For instance, despite the recently passed Liberian Refugee Immigration Fairness Act that gives reprieve from deportation for Liberians of temporary status, many Liberian refugees will benefit from this PCR bill if it passes. Today, these refugee and immigrant communities have family, U.S. citizen children, and strong economic and social connections to Minnesota. Our community members deserve redemption and a second chance like any other American. The current time limit on filing petitions for relief leaves out a community who deserve to challenge their convictions but were not informed of the opportunity to do so in a timely manner. House File 3975 addresses this problem, and that is why we are here to ask for your support. I want to conclude my statement. I want to close my by telling the story of Peng Vang, who testified at Chair Mariani's committee the other day. She is an impacted family member who lives in Maplewood, Minnesota, with her husband and five children. Peng is a nurse and pursuing a doctorate as a primary care nurse practitioner. Her husband came to Minnesota in 1989 at the age of nine and has since called Minnesota his home. His father served in the secret war in Laos, a war the US CIA organized and recruited recruited Hmong tribesmen as foot soldiers during the Vietnam War from 1960 to 1975. More than 50,000 Hmong people lost their lives. When his family arrived as refugees, they struggled not only with adjusting to a new world, but also dealing with grief due to the loss of family members in the genocide conducted by the Laotian government. They also struggled with racism and bullying in this new homeland. In the late 1990s, at the age of 17, her husband made a mistake and entered into the Extended Juvenile Jurisdiction Program. He was not aware of what this meant. Even though he successfully completed the 18-month program, a minor violation triggered 18-month adult sentence. It has been over 20 years since the incident, and her husband served his time and changed his life around. However, he has a removal order to be deported to Laos at any moment. Now he has a degree in computer networking and software engineering. He owns a information technology and software consulting business. He is a loving husband, father, son, and mentor, and community volunteer. Pang's story represents many of our community members' stories. We are asking you to consider giving people like Pang's husband a second chance so that our families can stay together and continue to make a positive impact in our community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Yang. Ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Lesh, representatives. My name is Linus Chan, and I teach at the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm also an immigration lawyer, and my students and I represent people held by immigration detention. I've also been asked to testify here because I've been working with the Post-Conviction Coalition on drafting this language that's in front of you. I want to be clear, the post-conviction statute can seem daunting and technical, but this change does not, as Chair Mariani mentions, does not change the substantive basis of the law. All it does is increase access to allow those to file post-conviction petitions after a two-year period. The current statute in the books now already recognizes five separate ways in which the two-year limitation has exceptions. All five of those exceptions recognize that there is good reason why someone may not have filed a post-conviction petition within the two-year period as they have. Some of them have to deal with being ill. Some have to do with a change in law. What we are asking today is this bill simply recognizes that because immigration consequences do not have its own statute of limitations, that immigration consequences, otherwise known as an actual consequence of a criminal conviction, can happen long after the two-year period, it is a good reason to allow someone to go back and re-examine why and whether or not their conviction was either unconstitutional or illegal. That is the totality of this statute. It sounds technical, but in its heart is simply giving additional access to people to have their claims heard in court. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Chan. Are there other folks in the audience, members of the public, who are here that wish to be heard on House File 3975? Seeing none, then we'll move to member questions. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have kind of a technical question. So I know there's not a fiscal note, and the next stop is the GR, the General Register. So when we had heard this before, because I'm on public safety with you, the fiscal note there basically had said something about that the court was unable to really estimate the change because of the lack of clarity of the language of the bill. So I'm wondering, do we have a updated fiscal note, and it has that language? Were they able to clarify the language and have better understanding of what's happening in this bill so that we know, do we have a fiscal impact to the courts or not?
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, when the bill was first introduced, I read the bill and interpreted that it would not have an impact based on discussions I've had with the courts on the number of cases that are required to drive the addition of a judicial unit. I have since recently thought that perhaps that was incorrect and submitted a request for a fiscal note, but since the bill was introduced recently and the fiscal note request was put in recently, it is not complete yet. I have put an expedited date on that, and if a fiscal note does come back in, it would be pulled from the general register and referred to Ways and Means.
Ms. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that we handle with procedural things, and you know, we had issue yesterday with a department bill coming up, and I just want to make sure that we're going at a pretty fast pace. So I just want to make sure that we're doing this correctly and accounting for all the money. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Neal. However, this bill was introduced last year. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So I want things to be correct as well. However, I had a UAV bill moved off the floor that had been on the general register for a year. And then the Department of Public Safety came in last week and said, looks like we got a price tag at it. So as far as I'm concerned, when things have been sitting out there for that long and any agency or the courts suddenly decides at the last minute that there's a price tag on them, as far as I'm concerned, they can eat that because they weren't on top of it. But reasonable minds may disagree about, well, they're still advisory. Fiscal is still advisory. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess it could be the bill author or any one of you three could probably, just more of a clarification, I suppose. So this would basically remove the two-year limit forever. So in the case of, like, Mr. Vang that you referenced, this is 20 or 30 years ago, he would be able to now apply for the removal of the eviction order. Is that apply for the review of that, right? Am I understanding that right?
So let me, Chair Lesh, Representative, to answer the question, it doesn't remove the two-year limitation at all. The two-year limitation is still there. With Mr. Vang, it would actually require a little bit on timing, because there is both under subsection C of the current statute, there's still going to be a two-year window in which someone has to file the petition. So just as an example, if we were to take Mr. Vang's situation, if he gets put into removal, has to report for removal or detained for removal, he would then have 2 years to file that petition. If he doesn't do it, then he's also barred based on time limitations. So while the triggering event, which is the place in removal proceedings, being detained for removal or having to report for removal, those would then start another two-year clock. So to answer your question, it would not remove it in perpetuity, and he couldn't just sit on a claim like that. He would have to come forward within a timely manner.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Mariani, I'm looking at the additional language on 2.6 through 2.9. And the proceedings that have been discussed are triggered by, and forgive me if I'm saying this incorrectly, you're an individual's immigration status or not.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, immigration law is pretty complex. Someone ask Professor Chan.
So there is no requirement on immigration status at all in the bill. It's agnostic to status. The way that status might come up, however, is if you are a U.S. citizen, you can't be placed in removal proceedings, right? You can't be detained for purposes of removal, and you can't be required to report for removal. So in that sense, that's the only time that status ever comes up. But there is potentially a situation where someone, and this has happened quite a bit, because as Representative Mariani has mentioned, immigration law is complicated. So there could be situations where someone thinks they are U.S. citizens, believes that they are U.S. citizen, and for the most part, even be issued a passport, a U.S. citizen passport, which we've seen, and then only later on have found that that has been deficient for some reason, and then they are put in proceedings. At that point, the issue, the triggering, the removal proceedings, detention for removal, or report for removal, would then allow them to then file for an additional review. So while it's agnostic of the statute on the actual status, it is possible for someone to ultimately be a U.S. citizen to make this challenge, and this might be particularly relevant for those, since now the U.S. government is taking more seriously the denaturalization route. that may come up, which is why it's important that this statute itself does not require anything on immigration status, whether it's a U.S. citizen or not.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So let me just maybe ask a clarifying question. And again, I apologize, this is not my marquee subject matter. But with regard to someone who has sought refugee status or asylum in the United States, and for purposes of, you know, drawing distinction, is found to have, let's say, a speeding ticket.
Sure.
And by virtue of a speeding ticket, goes to court and pleads guilty, but I forget the process, is put on probation for 6 months, and if you don't, an Alford defense, you don't need to put it on your record. It's vanquished if you're good for 6 months. Would that trigger this type of proceeding?
So, Professor, if I may, Chair and Representative, it's unlikely for several reasons. One, a speeding ticket itself is not a criminal conviction, so a speeding ticket wouldn't trigger this at all. And then specifically, this really looks after crimes that have direct consequences for removal. So speeding tickets or other, what even could be considered, a certain number of things that are considered not criminal, or even some crimes, don't necessarily trigger the removal aspect for people. And then finally, for someone who is, and it's unclear by your question, but if someone is someone who's seeking refugee status in the United States and they don't currently have any sort of legal status, the reason why this will not likely be directed toward that person is because the criminal conviction is not what is causing them to be removed. They're causing them to be removed simply for not having status. So the fact that they're not getting immigration advice about the criminal status is not likely what would drive this bill going forward.
Thank you. Thank you,
Representative. Representative Herr.
Chair Lush and Representative
Oh, Mark. I got it. Forget it. Representative Robbins.
Okay. Sorry.
You want to go last, right? That's okay. Well, Representative O'Neill is next. Okay. Forget both of you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just am confused because when we had the conversation back and forth, you had said that this language had been out for, you know, since last year. But the if you look at when it was actually introduced, this bill was introduced on March 2nd, which is only 9 days. So I'm assuming this is either a clone of the exact same language or this is a different language than what we had talked about previously. Can the author just clarify, since this was just actually introduced 9 days ago, not last session?
Sure, Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill is correct, and I'm gonna lean on counsel to talk about the differences between the two bills.
Okay,
sorry,
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I don't have a copy of last year's bill in front of me. The language is different. The substantive impact of the two bills is nearly identical. Okay. The language here is slightly narrower than the language that was in last year's bill.
So, Mr. Chair, so I'm assuming by narrower, we mean that maybe it's more clear and it's a little bit easier for the court to decide if there's a fiscal impact or not, because when we had a different bill, in fairness, last session compared to this bill. So I'm just, again, just trying to get clarity about the fiscal note, which I know that Mr. Walls had already discussed. But
Mr. Chair, this is actually an important question, because our attempt this year was to be able to narrow the impact. Which would have a direct bearing on the fiscal bill, but I'll ask Dr. Chan to comment.
Professor Chan.
The first iteration of the bill was actually a wider bill that did not restrict it specifically to removal. It would have been a wider requirement for any number of immigration consequences. So this bill is narrower in impact, not just in clarity. There is, of course, always an attempt for clarity, but that's not what the difference between this bill and the bill that was introduced last year.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's sort of my point is, although they're similar in the, maybe similar in the net effect, but I remember the other bill being much more broad So I just wanted to get that on the record that this language has only been out for 9 days. And I do appreciate what Mr. Walls said, that if we do have a fiscal note that comes back, it'll be pulled off the GR, because that would be of a great concern. We don't want to send it out without at least discussing the fiscal impact to the courts.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry to, I would happily defer to my colleague, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I don't have the benefit of having sat through the public safety hearing. And so just for my own, making sure I understand this, basically this is triggered by someone being given notice of a removal or being going to be removed based on the, but the basis of the removal notice is a criminal conviction. Is that correct?
Chair Lesh and Representative Robbins, yes, it's essentially removal that is based on the criminal conviction at issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so could you sort of just summarize for me what types of crimes would trigger the removal notice?
Professor Jen.
It's extremely broad. Some crimes, there is a broad category known as crimes involving moral turpitude, and that could be an entire course. It can be extremely broad. But common ones can include things like drug possession, even shoplifting can count as crimes that are based for removal.
One more. Thank you. This is helpful. And finally, so what this bill does is a person could be, based on a conviction, deported or given notice of that at any point, but you're saying now under this bill, what's changing from how things currently function is if they get that renewal, they would now have a 2-year time to file this petition saying they didn't get proper notice. Is that the intent?
Professor Chan.
Let me make sure I understand. The current way that it runs now is if a person is put into proceedings and the conviction is more than 2 years old, there is no clear method for them to get a post-conviction relief based on the time bar. This would allow them a 2-year window to file something that the court could consider, yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. Chair Liebling.
Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, and Representative Mariani, thank you for bringing this. I, in my previous life, worked as a criminal defense lawyer, and probably, who knows, maybe for somebody who would need to avail themselves of this, because I'll tell you, immigration law is very complicated, and most defense attorneys, I mean, I think now they probably are more schooled just because of everybody's more aware of the possible consequences to people's immigration status or to their continuing to be in the United States. But I have to say that many attorneys didn't and maybe even don't understand the immigration consequences and certainly don't do a deep exploration of the you know, whether somebody's a citizen or exactly what their status is. So, you know, often in this committee and in other committees, we talk about due process. Well, in law school, my professor used to say, due process depends on what process is due, right? And I would say that if we're concerned about justice and fairness, that this is an extremely reasonable provision. This doesn't give anybody any free get out of anything. It merely gives them an opportunity to have a day in court when they find out that something that happened maybe a very long time ago is now going to have a severe consequence that they or their then attorney never thought about or never knew could happen. So I think this is a very necessary bill. Personally, I would think, in the future, I'd like to see this be even broader because there are other collateral consequences other than immigration consequences that can be impacted in this way as crimes began to, collect more collateral consequences, this became more of an issue. But I think this is a very, very necessary safety valve, and I thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you. Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I was out presenting a bill in another committee, so I didn't hear the discussion, but I don't think this has come up.
so far in this committee. So just so members are aware, this two-year time bar is a relatively new function in statute. There used to not be any time limit at all on the filings of these post-conviction petitions, and we talked about this in the Public Safety Committee. I don't remember exactly what year it was, but staff had looked it up for us, but the two-year time bar is fairly recent. So folks that didn't know of these immigration consequences really had no incentive. 2005 is what I'm hearing, but really didn't have an incentive to seek post-conviction relief because there was no, you know, the time bar. And once that time bar was added, then it creates an added sense of urgency for these folks. Thank you.
Last comment question from Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. And Representative Meyer, I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this bill forward. I had a quick question for the professor, and I wanted to just make the committee aware that so we have a very large foreign born adoptee population in the United States. In Minnesota, we're one of the largest in Korean born adoptees. I recently was made aware in the past year that there were Korean adoptees who thought they were citizens. I think this touches on the professor's point about the fact that they thought they were citizens, that their parents finished the paperwork to make them citizens, and then they might have had some small thing, you know, possession of drug or something that young people often get themselves into. And then they now they have removal orders as well because of the change in immigration, and we have actually had deportation of our foreign-born adoptees. And I just wanted to make sure that this bill also covers those individuals. And if you could just confirm that for the committee, that would be great.
Professor Chan.
Chair Lesh, Representative Herr, there's no reason why this bill wouldn't cover someone in that situation. It is just a good example of why someone would not have gotten advice at the time because they thought they were a U.S. citizen.
Thank you for that question, Representative Herr. Do you have another one?
Yeah, I'm just a quick follow-up. So thank you, Chair Lesh, and the testifiers and Representative Mariani. I think that a lot of times when we hear certain issues, we sort of associate it with a certain group of people. And I just wanted to make sure that we are very clear in the fact that this is not a specific issue to the Southeast Asian community, that this is impacting other people who are foreign-born, who are brought here to this country as well, and that for us to ensure that everyone has due process in with this particular change. So I appreciate the bill, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm just reading this again, I just want a clarification on something, especially on the public record, to kind of help this case move along. But if the author of the bill, if Chair Mariani would help, in line 2.8, it says that the result of a conviction that was obtained relying on incorrect advice or absent advice from counsel. So that is privileged private information between the client and the lawyer or the counsel. So can you just kind of walk me through how that would be substantiated in a court of law to prove that the advice was either absent or inaccurate?
Well, I think that the short answer is, Representative O'Neill, that advice does have to be on the record. It's currently on the record. And if it's not, if it's absent of the record, that's a major issue. But maybe Professor Chan has a better answer than that.
Yeah, this language was specifically used to sort of mirror what happens now in a Padilla-type proceeding. So in Padilla, currently, since 2010, the Supreme Court has said it would be a violation of the Sixth Amendment if a person got incorrect advice. And so that process already happens right now for people filing post-convictions within a two-year window. They would need to prove that they got incorrect advice. I won't speak too much on how, but it could be anywhere between using attorney notes because the confidentiality is with the client, not with the lawyer. Mm-hmm. The client could, of course, release all confidential communications, including perhaps affidavits, notes, but that would be something that they would be required to do under the statute.
Thanks. And that was also just helpfully clarified by staff that the privilege is the defendant's, not the lawyer's. So, okay, you get that then. Thank you. There being no other comments from the committee and no one else from the audience or public who wishes to testify on House File 3975, the motion from Representative Mariani is that House File 3975 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, everyone. You're on your way to the floor.
Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the committee for a very good, thorough conversation, and Representative O'Neill and others. I'll certainly be tracking the fiscal note and circle back with you as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The last bill on the calendar is the revisor's bill. And if there's no objection, I'm just going to present that from the chair. Although you're back, so we could do it if you want to, but it's the revisor's bill. So I'll move that House file 4044 be placed in the general register. And I think that Chair Johnson has reviewed it most thoroughly. Did you have any questions about it?
I do not.
And the deputy revisor is here if we have other questions.
Chair.
Representative Lucero.
I have reviewed it thoroughly, and I was going to strongly object to the or on line 11.24. But
you know,
Representative Barr talked me out of it.
This is not without precedent, Representative Lucero. In 2003, the concealed carry bill that was passed had a provision, and I don't know who's around here that even remembers this. Representative Mariani probably remembers it because he was the only other one who was here back then. But you had to put the sign on the door and tell someone that they couldn't carry the gun in Perkins.
It was great.
Okay. And there was that change from the and to the or, which was kind of a major change for the statute, but that change was in the revisor's bill. It's like, oh, it's just a change from an and to an or. And so there was a giant fight over the revisor's bill of and versus or. So thank you for bringing up that very painful memory. Now, why don't you just give me a nice paper cut and pour some lemon juice on it? that was a quote from The Princess Bride. So that being the case, if there are any other questions, I don't see any. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to be heard on House File 4044? My motion is that it be placed on the general register. Seeing no other discussion, all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 4044 is placed on the general register. Next. Okay, so before we adjourn, we've got the digital fare repair bill that's going to be coming up. And then a pending referral for Representative Lieblings. 4326, Representative Mahler's Uniform Canadian Domestic Violence Reciprocity Act, and then Representative Mahoney's Human Rights Bill 4100. That'll be up tomorrow, right? Is that mean tomorrow? Okay. There being no other business before the committee, committee is adjourned.